Welcome to I'm Fine. Hope you're all keeping well, and thank you so much for your continued support thus far for our channel. Today we're going to be talking about narcissism, and we have with us our amazing guest, Ms. Mrinalini, who is a clinical psychologist with TMC and who's also a celebrity therapist. Hi, and welcome to our channel, Ms. Mrinalini. Thank you so much for making time today.
Hi. Hi, Pratishtha. Thank you so much for having me over. And yes, this is one of my, unfortunately, but one of my favorite topics to talk about because it's more prevalent than, it's talked about. So I'm more than happy to spend my time and brief everybody else also on this. The more we talk about it, the better awareness we gain, the better people can have an insight that something like narcissism exists. And yeah, even scientifically, it's proven at least one out of four people that you meet in your life would possibly be on that sort of a spectrum. So if that's the frequency with which you can come across, of people who are on the spectrum, it's good to be aware about, what you might be headed into. And of course, I think the, bunch of questions that you have for me will definitely help people understand this better, prevent themselves, possibly help somebody who's also on the spectrum as well.
Maybe, I hope so. And I hope people who are not sure of what it is, if they find the video, it must be helpful for them too.
Absolutely.
Having said that, I want to ask some questions to set the premise because there are some terms I think people may not be familiar with. For example, is narcissism like you told about, is it a spectrum? Are there different kinds of narcissistic personalities like covert and overt narcissism? So what are those terms and what are the types of them?
Absolutely. So see, yes, definitely. A lot of people, very commonly speaking, we end up using the term, oh, you're so narcissistic. When you're talking about somebody who's a little bit more, let's say, self-obsessed, let's talk a lot about themselves, right? This terminology is used very loosely, just like nowadays we use this terminology like, oh, this person is so depressed. Also, you're having attacks, anxiety attacks, right? When that person just might be sad, right? And not ideally depressed, same as with, anxiety. You might just be feeling tensed or nervous and not particularly be having like a panic attack or an anxiety attack. But these things are used very loosely. Same as with the term narcissism as well. Now, all of us have narcissistic traits to a certain degree. Like you would want to talk about yourself, take pride in yourself, practice self-love as well, but being self-obsessed and your level of consumption of self being destructive to others are two very separate things. People with narcissistic traits, yes, are a lot about themselves, but their presence and their quality, their personality is not a destructive force to others. Whereas NPD, that is narcissistic personality as a disorder, yes, has certain destructive abilities to the people who end up getting associated with them, especially if it comes to children, especially if it comes to partners, family. They end up getting the worst as compared to, the outsiders in the picture because they paint a very different picture for the outsiders versus the insiders, people who have spent 24 hours with them or like a, longitudinal lifespan with them. Right. Yes. Talking about the types, there are like I like kind of like to define narcissism as, like you consider two paints, right? Let's say like a red and a white, right? There are so many degrees in which if you put the color red and the white, you'll have so many variants of, red, then pink, and then, a more on the pastel category or like a, very dark category. It becomes an entire spectrum. That's how narcissism works as well, right? But some of the most common ones are actually a very simple categorization, overt and covert, right? Overt just means outward, right? Those are the individuals where things like grandiosity, where they think too much about themselves, talk too much about themselves, like too full of themselves. You will see those things very obviously in them, right? Versus covert, on the other hand, is more of like, covered, kind of like, let's say a wolf, but in a sheep's clothing, right? There are a lot of people amongst us who might be like that, but you will never know till the point you actually, get to close quarters with them, right? And then you start understanding that, hey, this person's behavior, there are certain behavioral oddities. You're not really able to understand what it is, but being with them makes you feel very drained. And that's one of the, I think, the greatest red flag of a toxic person is they're not energy givers, they're energy drainers, right? You will feel very tired after being in their presence or communicating with them or in case, you know, you are in a family setup like that or in a relationship with them, that's one of the first markers that you will find that, you know, whenever I'm communicating with this person or even in their periphery, this person just drains me completely. I feel very exhausted, could be mentally, could be physically, could be emotionally, feel tired and exhausted all the time, right? These are the two broad categories, but there are many different types as well. Two of these are the most commonly seen ones. It's easy to kind of even diagnose somebody who's on the overt side because it's so out there. You communicate and you will kind of be able to understand that better. Covert is something which is a little bit difficult. It's tricky. It's even more manipulative. You won't know till the point you spend a considerable amount of time with that person to understand there's something wrong with this person. I'm not able to point out what it is. Right. Coming, you know, Pratishtha, to the question that you asked with respect to traits, right? One of the very common and obvious traits that you would find is they're not able to kind of understand your perspective. That's one thing that people struggle with the most, right? That is empathy, right? They have a very constricted empathy. There is a lot of research that has been done that if you brain scans have shown, you know, that their empathy, that is their EQ, their emotional quotient, is limited to that of just an 8 to 12 year old child, right? So you might be talking to a very intellectual person, and a lot of them have they're very high on their IQ as well, right? But IQ and EQ are two very different concepts. A lot of people think, you know, if you've got a high IQ, automatically you have a high EQ as well, or vice versa, nothing like that. Right, you can be somebody with a very high intellectual quotient but a very devoid of that emotional quotient, that understanding ability, that you're able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and completely understand them. The EQ is very devoid, and unfortunately it's something which can be slightly worked upon, improvised upon, but to create it to the level of, you know, let's say the age and the stage of life that individual at is, that's almost impossible, right? Because of which, that's one thing that you constantly struggle with. So yes, empathy is a big quotient, a big red flag you would end up seeing in that person. Their words and actions don't match. Like what they speak, the kind of promises they make, the kind of big commitments they might make to you, most of the times they will not get fulfilled. Why? Because they're just a part of love bombing. That initial love that they will throw at you, that you will make, that you, I mean, would feel, you know, that person is my soulmate, I found my perfect match. When in reality, that's not the case. They just want to kind of entrap you. And once, you know, they know that, okay, I now know a lot about you enough to ensure that you remain with me, that's where they actually, the mask ends up slipping. This is per se more with the covert side. With the overt side, it's a little bit more obvious. So not that difficult to like kind of detect that, right? Apart from that, they don't like to take accountability, right? Even if they say sorry, it's a very empty, it's a very hollow sorry. They would say sorry just because they want to be done with the conversation, right? When you're making it inconvenient for them, that is, you're expecting change and something to happen, that they kind of go back to what they originally was. That doesn't happen, right? So they don't like to take accountability. Obviously, this means they don't take responsibility for their actions also. They do these devious things, unfortunately, which causes a lot of, you know, you end up becoming a collateral damage in that, but they have absolutely no guilt, no remorse. A lot of people say, you know, no, but this person, you know, they cried, you know, and they feel very guilty because they're very good at analyzing and observing behavior. You know, like they learn a lot of how you're supposed to act and react in a like a social setup by watching people very closely. Exactly, right? So they're very good observers, and they're very good with conning, right? So if they see something, they can mimic that behavior well without actually understanding the depths of it. So it's at a very peripheral level that understanding or that emotional aspect goes, you know? And they are very consistent with being inconsistent, right? They're not consistent with any change. The only change you will feel they're consistent with is something that kind of benefits and befits their own well-being. Otherwise, if it's for you, if it's for, you know, anybody else's well-being, it's almost impossible to get that change. Even if it comes, it's going to be very transient. It's going to be very temporary. It's going to go off very fast, right? So you will just always feel, you know, that maybe I'm not enough. I need to be doing something more just to make sure this person kind of goes back to the way they were initially in the relationship or in the beginning, you know, before you were not, let's say, entrapped or trauma bonded to them.
And when you were saying this, I realized that Maybe they can't self-reflect. Is that correct? They can't self-reflect and see their own flaws and want to improve upon it.
Yeah, absolutely. Their introspective ability is very poor, right? They're not able to understand, they're not able to recognize that they are also at fault. You know, there's one ego defense mechanism. Ego means reality, defense means just defending yourself against reality. They don't like truth bomb, they don't like reality to be in the reality. They've created their own little bubble of a delusional reality wherein they are always either the heroes of the story or the victims of the plot line, right? That's kind of what gets them the attention, because they thrive on that validation, that attention that they get, you know, from their partners, right? And the partner usually is the kind of a person who comes with a lot of vulnerabilities, insecurities, and what you call as, you know, like a savior complex, right? So this person whom we call as the empath, because you're very high on empathy, right? You just want to give. Your limit is limitless. And that's what they kind of take, you know, the maximum use of, right? So you see this person as like a broken body that I want to fix, right? And you end up doing anything and everything it takes. You know, you end up in that whole course of, you know, the relationship or, you know, the dynamics that you share, even if it's a parent-child one, right? You end up giving a lot, right? They don't change, but your entire being exactly ends up changing. Your sense of self, your confidence, who you are, what you stand for, everything changes in their presence, right? And all of this happens, right, without them having an iota of understanding or reflection that maybe I could be wrong in the frame as well. Because like I said, there's a lot of victimization. They are always the one who's, you know, suffering all the wrongs of the world. In their eyes, they are right and everybody else is there to, you know, kind of get to them, right, or get the worst from them. But it's pretty much the opposite. That's why projection as a ego defense is very heightened in them, right? Whatever their insecurities and their lacunas are, their weaknesses are, instead of being called out for that, they will ensure that they kind of, you know, poke you on where it'll hurt you the most, make you insecure instead, right? So instead of working on themselves, they've just, you know, thrown the ball at your court. Now it's your problem to deal with your problems. And I don't want to kind of reflect on anything which might be wrong with him. That is another reason you most likely, this is the only disorder where you will find that usually the survivors of narcissistic abuse are usually the ones who end up in therapy than the narcissistic person themselves, because very poor introspective ability.
Yeah, and they wouldn't obviously want to accept that they're a narcissist, then that makes them look bad. So,
yes, absolutely. Most of them actually don't know that. A lot of people do ask me, you know, what if I'm the narcissist, right, in the relationship? And I always say, you know, the fact that you've come to me and you're actually questioning if you're a narcissist itself says you're not. Why? Because you peered in your within yourself enough to ask that question to yourself. Narcissistic people don't do that. They do know that they're narcissistic, but they never acknowledge it. So they absolutely are doing the kind of a mental, physical, emotional, financial, sexual, any sort of an abuse. They're doing it very much with the idea, very much with the conscious awareness that they're damaging you, and they go ahead with it anyway.
Another question I wanted to ask to clarify about some terms is, what is trauma bond and what is... Yeah, let's start with trauma bond first, because that also is quite a thing. And then I will go on to the next question too. I just wanted to ask a few terms before I start asking a little bit more about narcissism so that people might...
Absolutely makes sense. So basically, trauma bonding is, you know, kind of like mimics love. Like a lot of people who are trauma bonded, they're actually in a love or like a little bit of like an obsession or an addiction to love, which is actually traumatic. Right, and what happens is when you're used to chaos in life, right, maybe during your childhood or, you know, just in general in life, life has been chaotic for you, right? When you are naturally gravitated to these sorts of relationships, right, you don't find anything wrong with it because it's very familiar to maybe the house environment that you've been in, right? So lots of times people who end up in these sort of traumatic or troubled relationships have dealt with trauma, right? You might feel, you know, that no, I've seen this happening in my house, I will never let this happen to me, but you end up being in the same exact situation most of the times. The only reason being because when you kind of grown up looking at something, right, you end up normalizing that for yourself, right? When the same thing ends up happening to you, you don't really see a difference with it, right? And unfortunately, in our Indian setups, a lot of the times when there are problems within parents, right, because of various reasons, the partner might not separate, right? That's a kind of like a subconscious learning you take, that even though things are going wrong, whether it is physical abuse, sexual abuse, or verbal abuse, just even one slap, one verbal, discord, and family did not break the dynamics, you kind of end up going with that subconscious ideal that I am also not supposed to do that, right? You start normalizing and trivializing abuse, right? Trauma bonding is also basically being in a love which is giving you trauma, right? Very simply put. And what happens is, exactly, what happens is it's very cyclic, right? There are very clear-cut phases that you can kind of standardized, you know, see in a lot of people who've been in that sort of a situation. Ideally begins with this person, you know, whenever you feel, I say this, you know, that a red flag in a relationship is if it's going too fast, things are happening too soon, within a week's time you're in love, right? Might be happening in the movies, or it might be like by a law of exceptions that within a week, you know, this is the person. Most of the times that won't happen. But if you have come across a person, you know, who was doing things just going out of the way, right? Unusually out of the way, right? Falling in love with you very fast. Wanting to know everything that there is to know about your life, you know, your deep, dark secrets, your insecurities, your traumas, your fears. That's not the fact that they're very interested in you as a person. They are doing their data collection. They're just doing a lot of data collection. But you might have been coming from a background where you were not heard, right? Or you were not treated well. So when you come across somebody who's like a breath of fresh air, you know, is more of like a listener, you know, than wanting that attention on themselves. That's a very short-lived phase, right? Which we call as love bombing, right? They're throwing oodles of love on you. You are their favorite person, you know. They want to think about you. They're texting you and calling you and giving you, you know, a lot of gifts and compliments and being this very ideal person. Now, the ideal person concept is something that you have given them because you've told everything about yourself, what you want from a person, your dislikes, your likes, what you cannot tolerate, what you absolutely love. They've basically gained all of this information and converted themselves into a person that you want to see, not who they really are, right? So in a way, you're basically falling in love with like a perceived version of your ideal person, not the person itself, right? And once they know, you know, that now I know too much about this person, and this person has, you know, fallen equally deeply with me, and this person is not going anywhere, right? You know that person is entrapped, right? Now, after that, what happens is when the mask falls, right? Doesn't necessarily mean that, I mean, any person, you know, who's, you know, trauma bonding is necessarily a narcissist as well, right? Could just be toxic in certain ways, but ideally, maybe not on the spectrum. That can also be the reality, right? But the thing is, you know, that once you're entrapped, right? After that, the mask starts falling away, right? Then they start showing you your true colors. Suddenly, those grand gestures, those gifts, those compliments, texting and calling daily, you know, saying, I love you 10,000 times, you're my soulmate, everything changes, right? And then they actually start treating you the kind of a person they really are, right? And you're left wondering as to what changed. And they're very good at making it seem as if it's your fault. And you spend the rest of your time, you know, becoming this ideal person for them, right? You will change yourself. You will bend yourself back and forth to convert yourself into this person that they want, you know, out of you. And they're very good at making you insecure also. They will compliment other people in front of you, right? Anything that you deserve is something that they're giving to everybody else, right? So you wonder that, is it me? Am I not enough? Should I do something more, right? You will try to change yourself. And you will guilt trip like anything because you're a good person, right? And you feel, maybe I've wronged this person and maybe I need to do something to change. Again, that savior complex hits, right? And in that process, you kind of start losing yourself in order to gain this person back. And that's a huge, huge red flag of any sort of a relationship, when gaining somebody, bringing them closer to you, means losing your own sense of self. And that's a very, very common phenomenon in these sort of relationships, right? It becomes a back and forth, basically. It becomes you kind of being addicted to love, and yet that same love is kind of traumatizing you. That's basically what trauma bonding is, you know? You're bonded with them, but out of that trauma, right? So in these relationships, there's a lot of like blocking and unblocking, right? Getting into the relationship, a breakup, and then a break, and then, you know, you're back together. And you kind of put this on destiny. Oh, no, no, we are destined to be together. We are soulmates, right? Because no matter what happens, we end up together. No, you end up together again and again because of the trauma bond, not because of destiny, not because you're soulmates, right? And you end up realizing this too late in the relationship, unfortunately. And you find it extremely hard to get out of it, you know? Like they say, you know, that being with them is problematic. Being away from them is a life you've not known, right? That's your kind, your ideal version of a trauma-bonded relationship, wherein getting out becomes absolutely impossible. Start feeling very, very anxious. Basically, mimics the withdrawals you would have when you would kind of try to de-addict yourself out of any substance, right? That's the time you know I'm kind of bonded, but with my trauma. And I want to get out, but I don't know how to. It's too difficult, right? Usually, the only way you end up doing is ideally via therapy. Right, you need a third person intervention, some accountability that can ensure you that you're not the crazy one, right? This is what trauma bonding is. You give them a lot of resources, they start working on themselves, they start building on their sense of self-worth, their identity, and that's how they start de-addicting themselves, ultimately coming out of the relationship.
And I think it's also kind of romanticized to be selfless in love, you know. So in the kind of relationship that you're talking about, I think they will get completely depleted, because they're just trying to better themselves and, you know, find out what's wrong, but they can never reach that space. They'll always be like on their feet and on the edge and everything. Okay. The next two terms I want to ask about is what is intergenerational trauma and trauma response?
Yeah.
See, and if somebody's gone through narcissistic abuse, what would be their trauma response in general?
Yeah. All right. Great questions, right? See, transgenerational trauma or intergenerational trauma basically is, you know, when you've been through a traumatic, you know, incidents in your life, instead of working on yourself and changing that, it's just being transmitted from one generation to the other, right? It's not stopping anywhere. Those dysfunctional patterns and family dynamics, they're not getting their end, right? So if two people get together, they have a lot of discord and trauma and dysfunctionality amongst them, you know, they end up bearing a child. Child ends up enduring the same thing, ends up getting into a similar relationship. They end up having a child together. The child grows up looking at the same exact thing. So from one generation to the other, same sort of dysfunctional behavioral patterns are flowing through, and it's getting worse, right? Unless and until somebody out of this pattern realizes, no, it ends with me, right? I want to be that wave of change. I want to stop this right here. I want to heal from my trauma. I don't want to be unhealed with unprocessed emotions, get entangled with somebody, have my traumas transmitted to them, us getting into an alliance, bearing a child who's already kind of, you know, getting raised in a very unhealed family dynamic, right? So that is how you end up stopping that by, you know, self-introspection, getting into therapy, getting help, and stopping it right there and there to ensure my future generations don't have to live through what I ended up living through, right? And that comes with a lot of responsibility, right? To in order to ensure that a change is required, and it's going to be a tough ride, right? But it's going to be worth it. And I'm kind of safeguarding my future generations from enduring what I did. And that's the most responsible thing to do, right? Coming to trauma response. See, trauma response is basically these, you know, responses one ends up giving because they have been in a traumatic situation. Even something like a savior complex, right? That's a trauma response, right? Because there was nobody to help you out. There was nobody for you to reach out, right? So you don't want anybody else to endure what you did, right? So whenever you see a broken body, you want to help them, right? A lot of people who end up going through narcissistic relationships, the survivors of the same, we call, they have endured what we call as NAS, narcissistic abuse syndrome, right? Because it mimics a lot of things. It mimics symptoms of anxiety, symptoms of depression, grief, PTSD as well, right? And it's the most confusing phase one endures, right? Lots of things ends up happening as a collateral damage, right? They end up having a lot of brain fog. There are memory lapses. Why? Because of heightened amount of gaslighting, right? Making you believe things which didn't happen ever, right? Lot of emotional manipulation, right? Because of which you start questioning your own reality. Did this even happen or not, right? Or is this just a fiction of my mind? Why? Because it befits them, right? But in that sense, you end up having a lot of memory snags, right? Insomnia ends up happening, right? Your mood is at a constant flux because, like you mentioned, you are always on the edge. You don't know what word I will say or what my action might cause a, you know, reaction in that person. Maybe from one day, you know, me being their soulmate, the next morning, you know, we are back to a lot of verbal abuse. Maybe it turns into, you know, physical fights as well, anger outbursts. You know, the person wants to kick me out of the house and never see me again, and that's very confusing for you because it's very inappropriate to the situation which has actually taken place, right? And they're very good at derailing, right? Taking the, you know, focus of the conversation from A to Z, right? So that you don't come across certain situations wherein they have gone wrong, because they will not take accountability, they will not take responsibility, they will deflect it on you. So that it becomes your problem. Why? Because you would want to change yourself, right? Besides this, of course, you know, you become an anxious wreck, right? Your mood is always debilitating, right? There are crying spells that are happening. You are always in a very confused state of mind. They're very good at cutting your ties with people who are close to you. So you become very isolated, right? And because you did that and people kind of left you along the way, you're left with nobody. And even if you're trying to tell what's happened with you, going through something narcissistic is something one of a kind. Exactly. Nobody will understand. Maybe two people can. One, people who themselves have gone through it, so they kind of get it. Yeah, you know, I've been through something similar. Or a trained professional. And unfortunately, even in our field, not every therapist is trained on or has seen or worked with a lot of individuals who are either narcissistic or have been through narcissistic abuse. Right, because of which at times help, maybe they're not able to receive the kind of help they need, right? So you're left very confused, right? Your sense of self is always in question. Your self-worth is gone, right? You don't know who you are, you don't know what to do with yourself, your goals, ambitions. Pretty much it's a 360 degree destruction basically that has happened in your life, right? A lot of people unfortunately become suicidal because of that, because they don't know where to from here. I've lost everything along the way, maybe a lot of money, my time, my energy, right? So from that to kind of, you know, click on that reset and restart button, I think it's one of the most courageous things to do, right? So all of these things, you know, that I was defining, these are all responses to trauma. A lot of people don't understand you are seeing what you're seeing and behaving the way you're behaving because you've endured a lot of trauma in your relationship, right? And yes, the person that you felt, you know, is your soulmate and you held the closest to was all throughout working against you like your enemy. Maybe your enemy would not have done the kind of things to you the way this person ended up doing to you. So you end up towards the end of it kind of losing your hope and faith in people and humanity in general. And from that to, you know, get yourself back on track is a very difficult process. But I definitely say, don't go in for rebounds. Give yourself a minimum of 6 months. See yourself completely transform and definitely seek professional help.
Could one of the trauma responses be people pleasing as a byproduct of being raised by a narcissistic parent, for example?
Yeah.
Because they always have to satisfy the narcissist.
Exactly. And yes, now even when in those parenting relationships, what happens is in a parent-child dynamic, right, you end up wanting to please your parent. Every child wants some sort of an attention and validation from the parent that, yeah, I'm good, I'm doing good for me, right? And because in India, we idolize parents, we put them at this pedestal, right? We cannot fathom they're not working in our favor. They're working against us, right? So with the narcissistic parent and the child, what happens is the child that idealizes them, you know, is, you know, very pleasing to their unreasonable demands, right? Or they like to see you as an extension of themselves because they like their legacy to continue. They like, they would want more people like them, right? Ends up becoming the golden child, their favorite child, right? The child who opposes this behavior, calls them out, breaks their bubble of reality, wants them to understand you're not good, right? Ends up becoming the black sheep, somebody they do not like, right? And they create this discord even between the parents and the child a lot many times, right? The other parent, you know, who's, you know, you're relatively closer to, right? They have a big jealousy component as well, right? They're jealous of you, maybe your appearance, maybe your achievements. They will not acknowledge, they will not validate those things, right? And if your closeness with the other parent, that toxicity goes there as well. You would also try and poison the other parent so that you distance from them. Even between siblings, if you're close to your sibling, they can be that barrier. You know, start saying things about you that have never happened, right? Start with these rumors. And for you, it's an absolutely unfathomable thing that somebody who's brought me to this world is literally working against me, right? Is working, you know, kind of like my enemy. And it's a absolutely a debilitating thing, because maybe with a partner, you can cut them off, right? But when you're younger and, you know, you're under that parent, it's very difficult to, first of all, accept this is who my parent is, right? And then not know what to do, because you're still maybe a minor. You still have to kind of live through that sort of a behavior. And that alters your sense of self a lot. So a lot of children, you know, who've been under like narcissistic parenting, right? Their self-worth is low. Their self-confidence is low. Like you said, people pleasing is there because they always feel so worthless. They are trying to please their parent all the time because you're young, you're naive, right? You look at your parents as protectors, right? You want that validation from nobody but your parent. You want to please your parent all the time, right? So you end up mimicking those behaviors in your actual relationship also as an adult, right? Till the point somebody kind of raises that understanding that, hey, you know, this parent-child dynamic that you shared, this is not normal. This is not what happens in my household. And that's your first breakthrough, your first realization that, wait, what I was going through is not normal. This is not how other families function, right? But by that point of time, it has really changed your sense of self, right? And for those kids, unfortunately, like I said, you know, you end up mimicking that trauma. Why? Only because of familiarity. So a lot of kids who've been raised by a narcissistic parent end up getting into narcissistic relationships, right? Because at the end of the day, at times they think they get the love they deserve, and that is the kind of a love they deserve, because they never found their worth, they never valued it. So of course, if you don't value yourself, you might end up with a person who will also not value you.
And usually when people are in an abusive relationship or a narcissistic abuse in relationship as well, it's not that they realize it most of the times that they are being abused, like you say, unless there's this moment where there's a, you know, person who's pointing it out and it also makes sense to them at the same time, they don't realize it. So what are the signs that tell you that the relationship is abusive, like the signs that show up in the narcissist and the signs that show up in the person being abused, which can tell you that, okay, this is not all right, so that you can intervene or tell that person this is not okay?
Right. Very good question again, Pratisha. I would say the first thing is, you know, again, some things are actually consequential to our cultural dynamics as well, right? The way we end up defining abuse over here, right? It's not abuse if it's just one slap. It's not abuse if it's just one showdown, you know, of hurling a verbal abuse, right? It's not abuse if once you were coerced into getting intimate when you didn't want to, right? It's only abuse if it's happening repeatedly, right? And a lot of times, you know, we are kind of seen growing up with the concept of nibana padta. You know, now you're married, you have to deal with this now, right? When you don't need to, right? Most of the times we end up normalizing or trivializing abuse because we don't understand the concept of abuse. A lot of people, when I talk to my clients, is a lot of them, they don't understand, wait, what I've gone through, is this trauma or not, right? Because they feel that there's a standardized definition of trauma. Ye hua hai toh it is trauma, otherwise I don't know if this is trauma or not. This is very much trauma. Trauma doesn't have to always be visible. Emotional trauma and emotional abuse is the characteristic definition of a narcissistic relationship. Financial abuse, sexual abuse, right? All of these components end up coming besides maybe physical abuse as well, verbal abuse as well, which may or may not have happened to somebody, right? But emotional abuse is very, very much a sign of trauma bonding, a sign of, you know, you being in an abusive relationship, right? Because this person is constantly changing your sense of self, your reality, your worth for you, right? Kind of being very intricate. I kind of like to call it at times, you know, like a slow poison, right? It's being injected in you, but you never know till the point it becomes so much, you know, it kind of, it you're not able to bear it. It becomes unbearable for you. That is the point that you end up completely breaking down. And that's usually the point of time people end up realizing, you know, that whatever this is not working out. This is very, very toxic for me, right? Because before that, you will keep on trying multiple times, right? Why? Because, again, the people pleasing, savior complex, guilt tripping, all of these things come up. And what happens is you end up looking at the narcissistic person because they victimize themselves so much. You end up kind of taking the role of a parent for them, a parent which was not there in their life, right? And whenever you think about leaving them, a lot of guilt and shame hits. That I am leaving this person who needs a lot of my help. This person is so damaged and broken and unloved. And I want to just change this person and maybe this person will change for me, right? That's not the case. But this is mostly the biggest factor because of which you end up, you know, not leaving that sort of a relationship, right? But yes, with respect to these traumatic experiences, I think one of the most common features is your sense of self will change. Right, that's one of the greatest red flags to be working with. You will not be who you were, and people around you can vouch for that. They can tell that to you, that you're not the same person as who you were prior to the relationship, and not for the good but for the worst, right? They're big time energy drainers. You're always exhausted in the relationship. You don't want to dress well, you don't have the energy to go out, right? You don't suddenly are working towards, you know, your goals and dreams and aspirations. You know, you're just very placid, very done with life, you know, like just going to work, eating, sleeping, doing the bare minimum, right? And your relationship is actually all about bare minimums, right? That breadcrumb of hope and love that you're surviving on, that's the definition of a relationship. I think those three are the most characteristic definitions, I would say, is definitely you are in a toxic relationship, right? Exactly.
And do narcissists never change? And So do narcissists never change? And like we spoke about, like how do they become narcissists? Like because of intergenerational trauma that we spoke about, is narcissism maybe in certain cultures like Indian culture, is it internalized because their parents' behavior is like normalized? Parents, I mean, there's general authoritative parenting styles when it comes to very old generations of parents in India, and they tend to, you know, say stuff like the mom can yell at you but you can't yell at the mom because she's your mom after all, and things like that. So are many of the narcissistic traits normalized because of generational trauma and culture? Is that how they're made?
True in some ways, yes. A lot of things unfortunately are certain things based on cultural things as well. Not that, you know, I mean, it doesn't discriminate at all, and mental health conditions can happen to anybody and at any point of time, no matter, you know, what the differences are, right? But yes, culture and the kind of a societal setup that you grow up in also can at times augment or add to certain, you know, situations becoming worse, right? Just like any other mental health conditions, a little bit difficult, you know, to ascertain that this is the cause why this sort of a problem end up happening. But yes, trauma is a very big causal factor. So is like the genetic and the biological inclination too, right? The environmental factors are just like augmenting factors. Societal, you know, expectations and behavioral outcomes are again just an augmenting factor, right? That is the reason you would find that if a parent or a child is narcissistic, there's definitely some sort of a genetic inclination which is there, right? There is a possibility that between the two, if there is a, you know, parent who has, you know, NPD as a condition, the child, if doesn't, let's say, end up developing the similar disorder, would end up, you know, having some sort of a mood dysregulation, right? Or would end up at least with narcissistic traits. You know, if the traits are there, and, you know, maybe the child ended up joining therapy or the other parent kind of helped, you know, in dousing those traits down, you know, and working with the child, it can ensure, you know, that the child does not kind of develop the same personality disorder. But yes, in most of the cases, we have found that there has been a genetic inclination. One of the two parents or somebody in the, you know, gene pool definitely was narcissistic because of them. They ended up becoming the same, you know. Their traumas ended up creating that disorder for them. However, your trauma doesn't mean you get the right to traumatize somebody else, right? That is the reason that with no other condition you find somebody else, you know, being in therapy, not because of themselves, but because of somebody else who's problematic in their life. NPD is the only condition which makes usually the survivors, you know, being in long-term therapy than the, you know, the culprit, the problem person itself, you know, because like we've discussed before, they don't really have an iota of introspection, right? I do have, you know, individuals who are themselves, you know, narcissistic, they have, you know, the diagnosed condition, and they are in therapy too, right? But the problem is that they are, one, because the introspective ability is very limited, right? The dynamics of therapy are not very direct, like that would be in any other, you know, kind of a person or a problem that you might be dealing with, right? So you have to be very particular in your usage of words, in the usage of, you know, certain tools and techniques to help them help themselves, right? But the biggest challenge one can face is, one, introspection itself, that I need to be here because of me, right? Most of the times they end up continuing because of the partner, you know, or because they don't want the relationship to end. And the only resort to keep that person in their life is if, you know, they are in therapy, or if, you know, let's say they're in couples therapy, right? Another issue is they're very inconsistent. Like, you know, we talked about this before as well. They're very consistent with their inconsistencies in general in life, right? So even when they join therapy, you don't know for how long they will be in therapy. The survivors definitely are very committed to therapy, but the narcissistic person themselves, we don't know for how long they will stick through, right? That's the reason we are very particular. At times, we do not even share the diagnosis with them, right? Some are able to take it and some might even be able to work with it. But for a lot of them, we do not end up telling them the clear-cut diagnosis. Why? Because they end up using it as an excuse. Oh, I cannot do this because I have NPD, right? No, you cannot expect this from me because I have a condition, right?
So well, they end up for their benefit.
They use it for the benefit. Exactly, right? So meaning to say, you have to be very kind of, you know, give them kind of talk in their own language to, you know, at times manage certain things. But unfortunately, it has a condition, even some, you know, other mental health conditions also, we don't really ascertain the word curative with them, you know, they might not be curable, right? If you are on the spectrum, you will remain in the spectrum. The only thing one can do is join therapy to just manage some of the traits. Douse, let's say, the anger outburst, right? The use of word, you know, the wording and the actions that can end up, you know, becoming a collateral damage to the person are things that we can work upon, right? But, you know, that in the integral part, you know, that integrity per se, the buildup of empathy, accountability, responsibility, those are very, very difficult. So meaning to say, you know, they can transiently change, relatively change, reduce, but never change 101%, right? And like I said, you know, that, you know, if therapy is something, you know, that if it's not internally driven, right, you cannot be forced into therapy, right? Even if somebody makes you come and sit, if you don't want to talk, if you don't want to listen, if you don't want to show up, cannot possibly do anything to make you stay, right? So that's a major, major concern with respect to, you know, more less of an implication for them, but more of partners, you know, who question, do I remain in this relationship? Do I remain in this marriage? Is this going to improve, right? So for them, the short answer is, with a narcissistic person is concerned, therapy for them is not just long-term, it is almost lifelong, right? Because they need somebody whom they can be accountable to. Somebody who's just a third-person party, somebody who has nothing to gain from them, right? Somebody that they can trust, somebody that they can, you know, be there, be absolutely themselves. But lots of time, initially, they are also trying to manipulate the therapist. You know, they are telling a lot of lies. There are a lot of, like, you know, inconsistencies with the narratives that they're telling, you know, which only makes sense, you know, when the partner kind of fills in the gaps for you, and that kind of ends up making sense, right? So yes, even though they are coming from trauma and we need to help them out, but you possibly cannot help somebody who refuses to be helped, right? You will find individuals who actually want to change, want to be helped, they will not victimize themselves. A lot of people who have been through trauma, even narcissistic abuse or trauma for that matter, they do not even like being called victims, right? They like being addressed more as survivors because they have that will to want to change and not be defined by their trauma, right? So while a narcissistic person is, you know, using, like you mentioned, trauma to their benefit, somebody who's actually endured that sort of a trauma doesn't want anything out of it. They want an out from it, right? But nothing out of it, right? So concluding on the fact that, yes, you know, with them, unfortunately, it is a condition which will maybe improvise to a certain degree, but you will never be able to find a fully functional, mature being, you know, who will be able to fulfill your needs and who will be able to remain loyal to you, would remain, you know, would be able to respect you or love you genuinely and authentically. Those are two things that they really, really struggle with, amongst many other things.
Are there any stages in which we'll realize that we're in narcissistic abuse? Because I personally felt like, you know, initially when I realized, okay, this person is narcissistic, I couldn't even accept that this person is narcissistic, because I've known that person all of my life and I've really loved them all my life. So it was tough. So denial was the first stage. And then after that, I tried to change that person by telling them, hey, you're a narcissist, and that didn't work out. And then I came to a place of accepting it and then, you know, letting go and trying to go no contact and things like that. So does it work in stages, like how people grieve in stages? It doesn't just change once you realize, okay, this is what has happened.
Exactly. You know, see, the thing is, Pratishtha, ki, in a way, yes, you can say, because if you see the relationship, you know, you can see the phases of trauma bonding, the narcissistic abuse cycle taking place, you know, from love bombing, you know, to then eventually starting with the devaluation, you know, and then going on to the discard, right? There are many other stages in between as well. So yes, in some ways, when you're, you know, let's say somebody is narrating how they were in a relationship, or somebody who's trained or somebody who's been through it, they can catch on it like this, that hey, this seems like a textbook version or like a standardized version of how a narcissistic relationship would sound like, right? But unfortunately, you won't get to know, like you said, you know, because you've never seen that person in that light, right? You've already accepted that person. You are bearing that guilt and shame in you for, you know, because you kind of acted like their parent, you know, you kind of act like they're all in one. A lot of people who are in such relationships, right? They end up becoming like an all-in-one to these people. But why? Because they have a very fragile sense of ego. They thrive on validation and, you know, attention. They need to be with somebody where they can exercise power and control, because they are not very accomplished beings themselves. They don't have a lot of sense of self-worth. Even they might project, you know, that they are very comfortable with themselves, you know, they love themselves and all of these things, you know. Internally, they hate being alone. Right? Why? Because their negative self-talk starts coming, which actually kind of breaks the bubble of reality. No, you're not a good person, right? Or you are a problematic person and you actually need change. That's why they like having these people, you know, like empaths who can keep on telling you, no, you're an amazing person. You know, people around the world, people have wronged you. You know, there's nothing wrong with you. So instead of kind of, you know, calling them out for their wrong, in some sense, you actually start enabling that wrong behavior, which ends up getting crystallized, right? And a lot of it is actually, you know, coming from their parents itself, right? Or even, of course, you know, because being a parent, you know, you're kind of like blinded by the fact, you know, that there can actually be some problem with your child, right? Because it kind of guilts me to feel that you know, I go wrong with my parenting. How did my child turn up like that, right? So lots of time with narcissistic, you know, a parent itself and that environment, they end up kind of, you know, thriving on the kind of an attention and the validation they end up getting, especially from the narcissistic parent, you know, kind of validating that sort of a behavior, encouraging almost that sort of a behavior, right? So we need to say that ends up remaining with them. And when they come across, you know, an empath who does that exact same thing to them, those things end up getting crystallized, right? Those stages are not evident to you while you're in it. Those stages are evident to you, you know, when you kind of reached your saturation point, right? And cannot take it anymore. Or somebody else, you know, tells you that, hey, you know, you want to choose between us or this person, right? Or you end up in therapy for some other reason. A lot of times, you know, when somebody from such a relationship or such sort of a parenting comes, they're coming to help themselves. But when they start telling me about their background, they start telling me about their childhood or their relationship history, and they end up realizing the problem is not with you. The problem is with the person you're with. The problem is with the parent. The problem is with your environment, right? That's like an aha moment for them. that, okay, so all throughout I'm not crazy, I'm not psychotic, I'm not the one who needs help. You need help from the damage which has been caused to your sense of worth and your sense of self. Yes. But the actual realization ends up happening only and only when you talk to somebody who's been through something similar, or you end up in therapy, because a therapist can actually psychoeducate you on all of these phases that look a lot like trauma bonding or look a lot like a narcissistic relationship, right? You don't end up getting to know about it till the point you reach out and you start looking at it as a third person perspective. And a lot of times, initially, there's a lot of resistance because, like you mentioned, right, you've known this person maybe all throughout your life if it's a parent. Maybe, you know, you were really good friends with this person, you know, before you ended up getting into a relationship with them, right? The point being that realization, as relieving as it is, it's equally heartbreaking when you realize that love wasn't love, right? That love was a form of manipulation, right? Something that they did only to befit and benefit themselves, right? So there is an initial breakdown before you actually start, you know, getting back on track and kind of rising up. But I always say, you know, when you kind of hit rock bottom, and in these relationships, you often hit rock bottom, right? And you never get a closure. They start with a bang, they end with a bang. Right, you're always looking to look for closure from that person. But I always tell everybody, you cannot heal from where you're hurting. Right, what you don't realize in the relationship is also, you know, that you reach out to this person to heal you, not realizing this is also the same person who hurt you. Right, how can that person heal you when they themselves are the ones who are hurting you? Big red flag and a big eye opener for them to understand that, yeah, I am with a toxic person. I am with a narcissistic person, right? And I need it to end, and that's the only redemption from me for it. Otherwise, it will always be a push and pull. It will always be me being on the edge. And your wear and tear will result in a lot of emotional, mental, and physical trauma that you are enduring on a daily basis to the point you actually take a step away from this environment, right? So when you cannot change your environment, you change either your narrative or you change what you can about yourself, right? The decision at the end of the day lies with you, right? Whether you want to remain in that or you call it ends. And that's also another way you are ending transgenerational trauma too.
Okay. But you know, we saw some narcissistic traits in romantic relationships, like love bombing and everything. And we saw some narcissistic traits in familial relationships with a mother and a daughter, or a father and a daughter. But how does narcissism manifest in a work environment? Like, how do I know this work environment is toxic? Somebody here is being extremely narcissistic.
Yeah. Actually, you know, Pratisha, a lot of people end up having, you know, narcissistic superiors, bosses, right? And that makes it even more difficult because this is the person, you know, that you're reporting to. This is the person you asked is have to please. So everybody who's like a subordinate to them ends up, you know, kind of validating their behavior. Why? Because I need this person to give me a good appraisal. I need this person to promote me, right? My being in this environment is dependent on this person, right? The traits are not that far away, right, from a narcissistic parent or a narcissistic relationship, right? The trajectory is different. The only reason being, the amount of time you spend with that person is the duration of you going to the office, but that's about it, right? With the parent, it becomes, you know, lifelong till the point you are housing at least with that person. With the partner, it is till the point the relationship is there or the marriage sustains, right? So your time periods with these two people is more, but with your boss is very limited, right? And there's no changing because maybe your boss is not going to therapy or doesn't even know, you know, for a fact that they need help, right? But the point here is their traits are also going to be very, very similar, right? You will always feel you're not enough, right? That person will curate scenarios which have not happened. There will be a lot of rumors around you, right? They will make your living and your being in the office environment a living hell, right? Why? Because if they don't want you around, they will ensure they create an environment that you yourself quit before they push you out, right? And of course, your assessment, your appraisal, your promotion will not be based on your performance. It'll be on something random, right? Just like in the other two relationships as well, right? you are kind of, you know, a gun is put across your head, not for actually what you might have done. It can be something super duper random, right? We will make an issue out of anything or nothing for that matter, right? So when you're not able to cut such a person off, because you cannot keep switching from job to job in such an environment, right? The only thing you can work with is kind of like a phenomenon called gray roping, right? Wherein I cannot cut off this toxic person from my life, right? But I basically turn like kaam se kaam karna, right? I rid myself of any emotions, right? I stop being, you know, kind of perturbed if they try to touch on my insecurities, my vulnerabilities. And with bosses also, if you overshare about your life, right, they will start using that against you, right? And that fear will make you not be able to leave as well, right? If it's turning that toxic, definitely the only solution out is that you quit, right? Before this professional relationship ends up getting highly personalized for you, right? But if that is not the case and you can somehow manage, then gray rocking is a technique that you can use, right? It's kind of like a high for a high, a how are you for how are you, not a word more, not a word less, right? Bilkul kaam se kaam maintain karna, and that's about it. The relationship is absolutely formal. It's rid of any sort of an other extra effort and an extra mile you would take otherwise, you know, with your colleagues or with somebody who's not narcissistic, right? So you won't be like kaam se kaam sort of a person. You will exchange a little bit of a dialogue as well. But with them, you won't. You are not engaging in any extra conversation. You're only doing and giving as much as is asked, right? And you've completely rid yourself of emotions. You do not give them any reactions. That is a key, which is an answer to pretty much any person who has a narcissist in their life. Stop reacting towards them. If you react, it's kind of like a sinister and enjoyment that they get out of it. You know, all of us find there's a little bit of a smirk on their face when they see you troubled, when they see you crying. They don't want to take care of you. You are being an inconvenience to them, right? So you need to ensure you stop getting perturbed by the words, by their actions that are being given. There is no reactivity from your side whatsoever, right? That stops them at least from kind of targeting you all the time. Unfortunately, the target can shift, at least in workplace, right? But in a family environment or in a relationship, you still end up remaining targeted. It's just that it kind of reduces that effect that negativity can have on you. So it's a plus one for you, not so much for them, right? But yes, that's one of the techniques that one can use in case they are in an environment where they are faced with a narcissist and they just cannot cut that person off their life. Good technique one can use, right? Instead of giving back to them and showing them their place and doing all of those things, you are basically engaging in a banter that they are thoroughly enjoying. That's what they thrive on, right? When you're getting irritated and you're giving explanations, you know, and you're getting bothered or you're crying, right? You need not have to feed them that sort of an entertainment and keep just to yourself. That's one of the many things, you know, that we also teach in therapy, just to ensure that for not everybody, unfortunately, cutting such individuals out is an option, right? And when that is not an option, these are the things one can do just to sustain till the point you find some other sort of an alternative to your problem.
So, why do people enable narcissists in a work environment? Like you said, there's some sort of an explanation, but in general context, like a family or just in friend circles, for example, how come people aren't able to see that the narcissist is actually bad, and why do they end up enabling and perpetuating their behavior towards the victim?
Yeah, actually, you know what, Pritesha, the issue is lots of the time they don't know that person is a narcissist, you know, and they will find you crazy to be seeing that. Right, and this happens a lot when people get out of these relationships, right? Or even in the parent-child dynamics, when you start going out and talking about this person, the interesting part is that they keep their outside image very pristine. Their outside image is very important to them, right? So they will try to maintain their friendships, right? They will always try to, you know, be this such a, you know, let's say for example, a very God-fearing person, very naive person, you know, somebody won't even kill a fly. Right, when you keep this sort of a stance, somebody will not lie, right? When you keep such a pure and a pious stance, you know, and suddenly you come out and say, you know, oh, this person has been verbally and physically and emotionally very abusive to me, nobody will believe in it, right? Why? Because there have been so many times where they've created situations, they've poked you where it has hurt the most by being very silent, right? And once you reach a saturation point, you kind of roar back at them. They will ensure that roar back that giving back that you're doing, it's happening in front of a lot of people, right? So that there is evidence and there is proof that you're the crazy one. You're the person who's aggressive. You're the one who's controlling. You're the one who's tormenting them, right? When in reality, nobody knows the truth. Why? Because for the longest time, in order to safeguard your own reality, you don't want to tell that other people that my partner is actually abusive. Why? Because it hits your ego as well. It hurts you to accept that, right? That maybe my husband is this way with me. So for the longest time, you protect their image like anything. You would keep on talking about them. It's almost as if amongst your friends, amongst your family, people who don't know about this person will always find this person a little off. But you will always end up talking a little bit extra, right? And others will find you, why are you trying to always convince us this person is good? Because if the person is actually good, the actions speak for themselves. You wouldn't have to speak on their behalf, right? But for such people, you end up over-speaking, right? Not knowing you're actually enabling their wrong behavior. But the thing is, you want to protect your own image also, right? You don't want to go around family telling people that this is what actually, you know, happens behind closed doors, right? That is the reason you also end up at times becoming an enabler. But coming to the question that you said, you know, that why once that reality is out, why aren't other people, you know, instead of blaming that the, you know, the survivor itself, you know, that, oh, couldn't you see? Why did you remain? They talk as if it was that easy to quit. No, it's not, right? It's a very, very difficult task because it's like no other relationship or no other breakup of a dynamic that you will ever go through. It's a one of its kind, right? It's extremely difficult to get out of it till the point that somebody who's a very strong person in your life, or you've had it enough and you are emotionally a very strong person, right? Or you seek help. Those are the only forces that can help you to come out of it, right? Because before even they discard you, they will start their smear campaign. And there are lots of these jargons associated to narcissistic behavior. They will smear campaign. They will start telling people how an awful person you are. And they're doing it on the sidelines, right? Or they have a lot of screenshots with them. The times that you got angry, the times you became bitter, right? The times you started speaking their language. They have a lot of proof on them. So you have to be very careful with what you're sending them. The words that you're speaking, you never know if you're on a call record. You don't know if they're taking screenshots, right? They don't know. You don't know if they're making videos without your consent. They keep collecting their evidences without you knowing ever. When you are collecting their cute messages, you know, when you're screenshotting something nice they wrote because you want to see and preserve the best in them, they are collecting their evidences against you so that they have enough proof to tell people how an awful person you are to them, right? And in contrast, you have nothing to show because all throughout when they were collecting your negative things, you were collecting good memories, right? So you have nothing but good to show to others, which is actually very abysmal, right? But they have a lot of bad on you in the meantime, right? So that smear campaign has already started. That is the reason people at times enable that behavior also. And you know, the thing is, unfortunately, you know, Pratishtha, at times when people are very self-absorbed, you know, that mentality that people feel, hamare saath nahi ho raha, toh how does it matter, right? And you don't call out such behavior because mujhe thodi na affect ho raha. My friendship is getting ruined. You know, you as a partner have been affected, you know, or you as a child have been affected, but that person's never done anything to me. So why should I break my friendship, right? Those are not your true friends because that person, no matter how toxic this person is also enabling toxicity. So that kind of speaks a lot about their mentality, that this person will not speak up or stand out when wrong is happening to anybody till the point it happens to them. Kind of similar to like your bystander effect. Nobody helping or just looking here and there, right? Nobody wants to break it off or call that person out and wait for somebody else to do it. And then maybe they might, you know, join the bandwagon and say that, oh yeah, I also agree to this. Not otherwise. Nobody wants to take the blame, right? Unfortunately, that's the reality because of which such individuals, their behavior ends up getting enabled, right? Instead of being called out, instead of being shunned, they end up victimizing themselves so much. And other people, their family, of course, is enabling them, right? Their friends end up enabling them. Why? Because unke saath to kuch nahi hua. And you yourself, for the longest time, spoke so well about this person, and suddenly you are flipping 360 degree. Who will believe you? That's a sad reality of such relationships and people who end up getting victimized with this behavior.
So, What would you like to tell to somebody who has suffered narcissistic abuse and is trying to come out of it, and somebody who's still not realized? How can they heal? How can they begin their healing journey?
Yeah, I would definitely, Pratisha, recommend firsthand, right? Communicate, start talking about it, right? Do not shy away from talking. If you can seek professional help, if it's accessible to you, please get professional help, right? Because they're the only people who can exactly guide you how to get completely out of the relationship as well. One of the first things we teach is going no contact, right? Delete, unfriend, unfollow, block this person. Also remove all flying monkeys. Flying monkeys are basically people who are enablers of their behavior. They are keeping an eye on you. And all the time, these people are keeping an eye on you. To the extent, even if tomorrow you're married, you have kids, you're happy with your life, they are still trying to stop you. They're still trying to hoover. The reason being, you were always nothing more than an object for them, a supply for them, a supply for either validation, money, pleasure, emotions, so on and so forth. Somebody was like an all-in-one, kind of like a caretaker for them, right? So meaning to say, they will try to find somebody similar, and unfortunately, if they're not able to, they will keep an eye on you. Why? Because if you loved me once, there are chances you might forgive me after some time and love me back again, right? So they always share a very unhealthy relationship with their exes. They'll always keep a track of you, even parents for that matter. When they need something, they will always start chumming themselves up to you, right? They always want to know where you are, how you're doing, what you are. So you have to ensure you keep your life very private and secluded to yourself, right? Because they can try to sabotage anybody new coming into your life, right? Or other friends too. So if there's a mutual that you share with them, do not hesitate to remove that person. If you know for a fact this person is double-minded, because the minute you talk about abuse and a person doesn't take you seriously to cut that person off from their lives as well, it means they're automatically an enabler, and you don't need enablers of any category in your life, whether it is a parent, whether it is a sibling, whether it is your friends, right? And you need to cut such people off. And going no contact is not easy, because the mind starts playing games with you. Suddenly you start recalling all that was good in the relationship too, right? And the therapeutic processes basically help you understand what trauma bonding is. You have accountability, and that, you know, a good rapport established with your therapist that this is something wrong that happened, right? But I'm not the only one. It is unfortunately more common than you might feel, right? My own 60% of my clientele is going through something very, very similar, right? So meaning to say, it is more common than you think it is. And that is the reason it's very, very important that you start vocalizing. Start talking about it. The more you talk, the better you will feel, and the more you might be awaring somebody else who's in something similar, right? You don't know how you could have possibly helped save another life, because you spoke about it, they got aware, and that is how the chain of awareness flows, right? So seek professional help, communicate a lot with your close friends, with interested people, and go no contact. That's like the go-to protocol to follow in case you have been in a relationship like that and you're desperately trying to come out.
Those were some advices. I mean, all the questions as well. It's something that really hit close to home, and I hope that it helps other people who have been in similar shoes as well. Because like you said, educating ourselves is the first step towards, you know, getting better idea and not falling back into the trap of wanting to go save them or give them all the love to, so that they change and things like that. Because that's something I believe people would easily end up falling to, like you said, because that's a natural reaction. We're not narcissists, and we tend to, you know, give love more easily. So I can understand that completely. And I hope this video helps people who are struggling. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for telling us a lot about narcissism. And hope you guys who are watching found this informative. Please do share it with people so that people get to know. And if you know somebody who's struggling, help them, you know, get educated as well and share this video. Thank you so much for being with us thus far. Thank you so much for your time. Again, see you guys in the next video. Bye, take care of one another, and be kind to one another.
Thank you, Pratishna. Thank you for having me, and thank you for the, you know, people who end up, you know, listening to this. We hope this helped. And of course, if you want to reach out, you want to get professional help, we at the Mining Company, we are here to help you. So definitely you can reach out to us as well. We'll be more than happy to help. And thank you, Pratishna, for bringing this topic. Much need of the hour, unfortunately, but happy that we could speak at length about this topic.
Thank you so much.
Awesome.